You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, January 22nd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On the program today, Janet Reitman. On the 41st anniversary of Roe v. Wade, what is the state of a woman's right to choose? It's a pun, because we're seeing that right stripped from women in many states across the country. Also on the program today, we've been waiting for it, that indictment of a governor. But it's not the governor you think it is yet. It's
still but we'll really still fun. Take it, yes.
Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, or I should say former governor, now former governor indicted Bob McDonnell, or indicted former governor Bob McDonnell, and his wife indicted on charges, federal charges, stemming from a series of financial gifts they received to, well, just because they were buddies with a guy who wanted access to, well, state workers as guinea pigs and perhaps some more official endorsements of his woo-like vitamins. Also on the program today, I don't know why I said that. He's not British. Also on the, speaking of the former colonies, we've got some sound today of that guy from the Shark Tank showing that he is either incredibly morally repugnant or just willing to play a person who is morally repugnant on television to make money. And Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper singing a Beatles song to Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm serious about that. Multiple arrests out at LaGuardia Airport on 2 days ago, protesting for a living wage for workers at New York City airports. Also, court decision, which shocked me just because I didn't realize it wasn't already law of the land, regarding the suitability for gay people to sit on juries. Sort of stunning, but it is the case. And can you imagine there was actually more chemicals in that tank in West Virginia than was initially reported by the company? I'm just so surprised that they weren't forthcoming with full disclosure. I mean, we know that we can trust these companies. We don't need to have any type of regulation on them.
Well, people will definitely exercise their free will to not do business with that company.
That's right. Exactly. We are no longer going to get our coal cleaning chemicals from you, company that has dumped your chemicals into our drinking supply. And also a hard-hitting piece in the New York Post. Why was it that there was snow on the ground on the Upper East Side of New York, the Tony Upper East Side of New York.
De Blasio halted a massive umbrella that Bloomberg was constructing that would only protect the Upper East Side from inclement weather.
It's a classic Snowdenista plan.
Time for that, a little snow in the Upper East Side.
That's right. Bill de Blasio borrowing President Obama's weather machine to wreak havoc.
Bill, I want you to be the first one to have access to the secret weather machine, and I want you to use it on those son of a bitches on the Upper East Side.
Those one percenters who didn't vote for you. Let them eat snow.
Let them eat vengeance.
All right. We will get to that and more. But first, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Janet Reitman. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Janet Reitman, contributing editor at Rolling Stone, on her piece on the stealth war on abortion. And it is, of course, the 41st anniversary of Roe v. Wade, Janet. And this continues to be to garner popular support, the idea that women should have control over their bodies.
Yep. Unbelievable, but true.
Yes, it's a shocking belief, but apparently there has been a shift in the way that those who believe that women are simply vessels to incubate fetuses, there's been a shift in their strategy in the way that they are trying to turn the clock back.
Yes, right. So what's happened in the past several years, it's become more prominent, I'd say, in the past several years, is that the quote-unquote pro-life movement, the anti-abortion movement, has kind of realized that their old strategy, which was essentially equating abortion with murder and making it all about the unborn fetus, wasn't working. It was making them look like extremists. You know, some of the tactics that they'd use, like, you know, barricading clinics or waving, you know, bloody fetus, you know, pictures in front of people and that kind of thing, that was actually marginalizing them. And I think what we're seeing is a definite shift in strategy, coming from the right overall, to look at how they can sort of whittle away at abortion rights by, one, attacking it at the state level, not trying to push it through the federal courts or through the Supreme Court, and two, sort of wrapping it in the cloak of women's health care, you know, making this about women, like, for example, you know, this idea of requiring women in many, many states in the country, for example, Texas, to undergo an ultrasound before they have an abortion. Among the many things that they may have to undergo is an ultrasound, and their doctor will then, you know, sort of describe the fetus to them and even show them, you know, the actual sonogram picture. All of that is you know, deeply embarrassing and humiliating for women, but it has also been portrayed as just a basic part of healthcare. We all need ultrasounds, or excuse me, yeah, ultrasounds, sonograms, ultrasounds. So, you know, why not? And in fact, you know, it's a way to dissuade a woman from getting an abortion because she wants to go through that.
Right.
So that's an example.
And overall, I mean, let's. I want to get into those strategies, and I want to get into the broader strategy. But let's talk about that. I guess that maybe it's more of a tactic. This pushing this notion of it. Well, let's actually start with what precipitated this change in strategy. In other words, I mean, it's one thing to say that they became sort of aware that they were getting marginalized, but how is it that there was such a concerted and almost lockstep change in strategy? What precipitated it? Where is that coming from?
Well, actually, I mean, to be honest with you, it dates back a number of years. I mean, it dates back actually decades. And what happened was after Roe v. Wade, the anti-abortion movement, you know, which existed in the 1970s, began to figure out, well, how could we, you know, try to make abortion just simply unavailable at a more local level? If the federal government is going to say this is legal, is there a way to make it, if not illegal, then just basically, you know, unavailable, or just almost, you know, make Roe v. Wade basically moot? And they were very heartened by a number of decisions in the late 80s and early 90s, like the Webster decision and the Casey decision, in which the Supreme Court actually did allow states to impose certain kinds of restrictions if they wanted to on abortion, in the case of the health of the mother, in the case of, you know, say, federal funding. And those kinds of restrictions then, you know, signified to the pro-life movement that you know, there was ways that you could restrict abortion access. And they have been working stealthily for, you know, the better part of the past sort of 15 or 20 years at developing legislation that would restrict access or impose these kinds of regulations on physicians, regulations on clinics, and so it's not like everybody has kind of fallen lockstep behind this. I think it's something that's been going on for quite some time. Now, with regard to the end of the kind of confrontational tactics, I mean, you still see that. If you go to, you know, Ohio had a big, you know, rally. I guess it was last year or the year before over personhood, which is one of the amendments that, you know, that they've been passing, and you see, you know, I even on my walk to work in the morning, I see, you know, pro-lifers, you know, with some of those photos of bloody fetuses. So they're still out there. It's just that this is a sneakier and stealthier strategy, and it's far more successful than the prior strategy.
In some respects, and I think you mentioned Alec in your piece, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which has sort of a there's a parallel here insofar as there was development of this legislation, there was development of the strategy, and in some ways it was also just sort of built to be opportunistic. That the over the past decade we've seen more concentration by the Republican Party on sort of local races, and even we're starting to see the big money, you know, after Citizens United start to move into local, and by local I mean state and you know, and more localized. Is there an element of simply the strategy and the legislation was out there and simply waiting for its opportunity?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, the group that you're referring to is called Americans United for Life, and they are regarded within, certainly by you know, pro-choice activists as kind of the Alec of the anti-abortion movement. They write model legislation, and just as Alec, you know, kind of pushes that legislation across the country, AUL does the same. You know, they publish a playbook that comes out every year, and they distribute that to state and local legislators and federal legislators. And they sell this legislation on their website, and they will work with you to tailor it, you know, for your state, and they really break down all the various ways that you can go at the issue. And that's been going on for some years. It's not something that just happened in the past few years. But what did happen is that the makeup of state legislatures changed in 2010, and now you have, you know, more and more Republicans, you know, even in blue states like Michigan, which voted for Obama and really hasn't voted for a Republican since Ronald Reagan, they have an overwhelmingly Republican legislature. They have a Republican pro-life governor. And so you see a lot of success, you know, at that state level, even in blue states, at pushing this legislation through. And it's all, you know, honestly because of what we saw in 2010 with redistricting and tremendous amount of money, thanks to Citizens United, that's flowed into these efforts. And you know, the other point is you really can't separate the pro-life agenda and the larger conservative agenda. And I think, you know, I noted that in my piece, that's a kind of mistake that progressives often make, is they don't really see the connection between, you know, things like school vouchers or things like, you know, right-to-work legislation and trying to restrict access to abortion or make it illegal. And they're very connected. And, you know, you see this now even in just the focus that we're seeing when we're looking at the 2014 elections and what a big role abortion is going to play, and you know how leading GOP legislators are showing up to these kinds of rallies and showing up to these kinds of meetings. And so it's a very connected agenda, and I think we need to start looking at that.
Is it connected? Idea. I mean, is it simply a shared trait of a conservative self-identification? Is it connected because it continues to be sort of the electoral strategy of the conservative movement? Flesh that out a little bit for us.
Well, I think it's a combination. I mean, I think what we've seen is that you know, there are very few moderate Republicans left in the U.S. Congress, and certainly at the local level. You know, people who are considered sort of moderates are they're frequently pushed out, they're primaried, quote unquote, out. So, so what you see is a sort of domination of that Tea Party, you know, kind of very far right, very conservative mentality. If you're looking at the states, you're seeing a lot of that at the states. And so, you know, this just follows that while, you know, not everyone who embraces, say, right-to-work legislation is going to be pro-life, you know, pretty much anyone who embraces the pro-life agenda will also, you know, embrace these other conservative points because they're very much part of one kind of a worldview is what they refer to it. And you know, this has been a long-term strategy of both the economic right, like the Heritage Foundation types, and also the Christian right. And they've been working together through foundations and think tanks and that kind of thing for many, many years, very much behind the scenes. And what you're seeing is the sort of the fruit of those efforts. I can give you an example. 2 years ago, I was covering the Republican primaries, and I happened to go to a very sneaky meeting of evangelical pastors in Florida that was held by Christian right activists. And, you know, not only were they, and they met the Republican candidate, the primary candidates at the time, and not only were they sort of presented with this view that obviously they needed to vote for, you know, pro-life candidates, but they were also taught lessons about free market economics and why Jesus was actually a capitalist and why they should understand that if you vote for the person that will, you know, that will try to outlaw abortion, you're going to be voting for the person that's going to be, you know, right on economics. It's going to be conservative across the line. And that was a message that was sent to them. And these are the very grassroots people that then go back to their churches and they literally help register their congregants to vote. So that's how this kind of thing works. And it's just, the thing is, you don't get to see this I truly like snuck into that meeting. That's the only way I got to see it.
You know, I mean, it's interesting because I think we played sound from, I think it was from Virginia, Congressman Goodlatte, who was making the argument that abortion actually hurts job development because you presumably have less, I guess, people to care for. And it hurts job development in healthcare services, or it seemed a non sequitur, I guess, to those of us who are not sort of indoctrinated in that worldview. But the other thing that strikes me is, I mean, you mentioned sort of there has been a union over time between sort of the heritage think tankers and the evangelicals. Now it seems like it's no longer a union. They are the same people.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, that's you know, from all of my reporting over the past couple of years, that's basically what I've been, what I've come to believe.
Well, I mean, it's interesting
pretty much
because
the same.
I mean, the dividing line between social conservatives and conservatives, it almost renders the term social conservatives it renders it moot. I mean, in some ways,
they're just conservatives. I think that if you sit down and talk to people that you would consider kind of mainstream Republicans, moderate Republicans, what you're going to find is, first of all, a lot of them are retiring. A lot of them are saying, forget it, because they realize they're not going to win, or they don't want to serve in this kind of environment any longer. There is no, you can't really be a conservative any longer and not be a social conservative. And so those who object to that agenda are getting out of politics is clearly from the number of people that have announced they're not going to run again. And you see this, I've interviewed lots of people on the state level who, quit basically the legislatures they'd served in for 20 years or something, just in the past sort of 4, 5, 6 years because of the sort of radical ideological shift within these legislatures. And so that's what's going on. And, if you go to, if you go to some of these ALEC meetings, if you look at who is the state chairs for ALEC, a lot of these people are also endorsed by the big Right to Life groups. I mean, there's just very little separation between the two.
Yeah, and that's something I think that I'm sitting here with a couple of guys, producers who are nearly half my age, that I think for their generation, for people in the 20s, the idea of Republicans who are not anti-choice is sort of a strange concept. But in fact, the Republican Party was not always a function of a majority of social conservatives.
No, definitely not. It was really, I think it's only been in the past, however, 10, 15 years that it's really been since George Bush.
And George
Herbert Walker Bush was not nearly as far to the right on these issues. And
what was it that, I mean, and this is something that we've talked about on this program, for years, frankly, but it is, when you see it on a state level, what is it that is driving this? I mean, how did this part of the project, was it simply because the electoral power of people who are almost by definition zealots was simply too advantageous to the Republican Party? The analogy I use is basically they created a Frankenstein and now they can't control it. And it give me a sense of how that works on a state level.
Well, I mean, if you go back to sort of the 1980s or 90s, in the 90s, one of the very first things I ever did as a reporter just out of school was to do a story, about the Christian Coalition and how they were organizing. They were organizing. These are the far-right Christian conservatives, anti-abortion and prayer in schools and that kind of thing. They were led by Ralph Reed, who is now the head of a completely different organization. But they were hugely powerful. And these guys were taking over local city councils. They were taking over the PTA. This has been a strategy for, you know, for 25 years to, you know, not necessarily focus on the federal government, that the federal government is almost lost. Forget the federal government. Make it irrelevant. And instead, you know, take charge, or, you know, take control of your community, take control of your state. And that's what they're doing. And you see, you know, you see that sort of all over the place in every single state that, you know, first of all, you know, the people that come out and vote in those local elections are always going to be the more politically motivated, either to the right or to the left. You're not going to get a whole lot of sort of, you know, in-betweeners, because they tend to just vote in the national elections. You know, how many people do you know really vote for city council? You know, I don't know very many. I quite honestly don't vote for city council, you know, but,
Janet, you know better.
People that I know, kill me. I'm sorry. Well, but you know, what can I do?
Let's talk about some of the specifics of what's going on in the states. I mean, you start your piece with what has been called the rape insurance bill. Yeah, I mean, talk about that. I mean, this is not Michigan is not alone in passing a bill like this.
Right. So 9 states, including Michigan, have passed a law in which that bans abortion coverage from all insurance.
Private insurance.
Nothing to do with
the Affordable Care Act. This is just, you cannot
buy
insurance.
It's not just the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
Yeah, it's private insurance. So I believe the exception to that is if you have insurance through some gigantic corporate plan, it may be a little bit different for you. Like if you work for, say, you know, for Google or for some huge company, it may be different for you. But if you work for, you know, your basic company, or you buy your own insurance from a private carrier, you know, and obviously if you get anything from the exchanges, that was part of the deal, was that insurance coverage was not going to necessarily be included on the exchanges unless the states wanted it to be. The result is that, you know, a lot of states, I think something like 20 or 25 states, have abortion insurance exemptions of different sorts from their state exchanges. And 9 states say it's absolutely not covered at all. And only one of those states, which is Utah, will give the exception for rape. So in 8 states, if you're raped, and including the state of Michigan, if you're raped and you get pregnant, you know, you're out of luck. You're going to have to pay for that yourself if you want an abortion, or you're going to have to buy a rider. That's the really embarrassing part and the really awful part of it, is that it's basically asking women to plan ahead for their own rape. That, you know, your insurance does not automatically cover this procedure, but if you buy a separate rider in advance of any kind of incident, then you might be covered. And from what I understand, those riders don't really even exist. But, you know, they're sort of written into these laws that that's what you're going to have to do.
Right. The private insurance companies don't really see any value. I mean, this is,
yeah,
they're driven by profit, and they don't see any value in
right,
in providing those riders. So they, I mean, you know, people have to see the analogy with any other type of elective surgery that would be prohibited necessarily by law from insurance policies. I can't name any. I don't think they even exist. Let's move to the other states where we now have seen these other type of laws which are designed to limit access. Texas, of course, is one of the sort of the leaders in this type of movement. And we should say, the idea of making abortion safer for women is obviously on its face a rationale. But abortion is incredibly safe relative to other procedures, isn't it?
Abortion is incredibly safe. It's safer than, you know, most procedures. It's safer than a colonoscopy. It's safer than many forms of plastic surgery. These are procedures that are done in outpatient clinics. As a, you know, you can have these kinds of procedures done outside of a hospital setting. But only abortion clinics are subjected to a set of new regulations. They're called, they're referred to as TRAP laws. It stands for Targeted Restriction Against Abortion Providers. And what they do is they basically, make abortion clinics meet the standards of a real freestanding surgical facility where you're going to need wider hallways for gurneys, you're going to need specialized equipment for anesthesia, you're going to need like hands-free sinks, for, as if this was a serious, invasive, bloody surgery. And I'm sure that if anybody from the other side of things is listening to this, they're going to say, well, it is invasive and it is bloody. But I mean, in reality, you know, a lot of abortions don't even require surgery. A lot of people can take medication in the early phases of their pregnancy and in the early weeks, and that's how they do it. They take a pill.
And,
you know, other forms of abortion, the other form is obviously more invasive, but it's not a seriously risky procedure. But these laws are designed to impose these kind of onerous restrictions on the clinics, which are basically run a lot of them out of business because they can't afford to make those kinds of changes.
And we should say, I mean, you give that statistic about colonoscopies. I mean, this is actually pretty stunning, the numbers here. The mortality rate for abortions is less than 0.67. 0.67
right.
per 100,000 procedures for a colonoscopy, and this actually makes me a little bit nervous, is about
20 out of 100,000.
20 out of 100,000. I mean, that's about right. 25 times plus more dangerous, more apt to cause death than an abortion. And, a colonoscopy, you go in and it's like a dentist office.
Right. Exactly. You know, and I think it's a really important, I must say, I think it's a very important statistic to give because it is a procedure, a colonoscopy, that a lot of men will undergo. No man undergoes an abortion. They don't know.
Right.
But this is it, you know, and I really feel, you know, it's important that, you know, that the legislators that are making these decisions often tend to be men, and they should understand that, look, they're undergoing a much more dangerous procedure, actually, than the women. I mean, it's not, I mean, and you have, leading medical groups, you know, out there, the American Medical Association, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, they have all come out and said that this is a safe procedure. So it's just widely confirmed by the major medical bodies, and yet the line that is promoted is that this is a dangerous procedure, and they will seize upon the Kermit Gosnell case, which was the case in Philadelphia of the doctor that that killed fetuses. Actually, he after some botched abortions, he actually killed the babies. He went to prison. He's like, you know, a terrible example, but this is. The case that that the pro-life movement now seizes upon to show why it's so dangerous and why you need all these protections.
And so is there a failure? I mean, on a state level, is there a failure of advocates for a woman's right to choose to effectively communicate this? I mean, because clearly, you know, in Texas, when they say that we need to have doctors, or in other states as well, we need to have doctors who have admitting rights at a local hospital, and we know that many doctors have to fly in from out of states in a couple of states across the country because, Kansas comes to mind because, of course, there's been such violence aimed at these healthcare providers that they are afraid to be local. When we hear about these things about, you know, you need to rebuild essentially your clinic because we need wider hallways or whatnot. I mean, is there a failure for those who want to maintain a woman's right to choose? I mean, from a communication standpoint, is there just a larger infrastructure failure? Why have they been so effective?
I think that's a really good question. I think, you know, one, they bank on the fact that none of these restrictions seem that onerous to the average person, you know, including, to be very honest with you, myself, you know, who's, and on, you know, just looking at things on face value, what's wrong with wanting, you know, your clinic to be 100%, you know, up to surgical standards? You know, who doesn't want your doctor to have admitting privileges at local hospitals? It's only when you look beneath it and realize, oh, this isn't necessary, that you realize that this is part of the strategy to restrict the access.
Right, but not just necessary. I mean, if it was applied to, let's say, colonoscopies, and you would have to travel 400 miles to get your colonoscopy, I mean, it would become...
Would you do it? It would become a problem. So, right. I mean, this is, you know, so I think that it's been very successful because they have found ways to introduce what looks like common sense legislation, but actually is not common sense legislation. And they also are funded by lots and lots of unreported dark money funders. And so when you look at the budgets of these organizations, you know, Planned Parenthood actually spent more money in, I believe it was both 2010 and 2012, than some of the leading pro-life groups. But that's only a fraction of the picture. You know, they receive more direct money and donations than some of the other groups. But, you know, these other groups received a tremendous amount of money that went unreported. And so they are actually, the movement itself is funded exponentially more than the pro-choice movement is. And I think that's a huge, you know, reason why this stuff is now making such an impact.
You know, yesterday was the Citizens United, the fourth anniversary of the Citizens United ruling, and people should understand that this, in the same way that Citizens United reinforces sort of a plutocracy in this country, people should understand that dark money that goes to these groups as a function of Citizens United is also the real victims of this end up being middle class and poor women who don't have the economic ability to go to the next state, to take a day off, to get childcare, to get this procedure. And these roadblocks first hit and predominantly hit women who don't have the resources.
That's right. Exactly. Well, and absolutely. I mean, it's, if you look at, you know, for example, the campaign to defund Planned Parenthood all over the country. I mean, Planned Parenthood is you know, in terms of offering abortion services, that's something that some Planned Parenthoods do, not all. And really, what Planned Parenthood does is family planning for, you know, young women who I always talk about this. Like, you know, when I was in college, my friends, myself, everyone I knew who was, you know, 18, 19, we all went to Planned Parenthood. It was a way to, you know, break away from our moms and break away from our, you know, traditional doctors and our families. It was like, you know, sort of being independent. It's where you get birth control. And, you know, it's also obviously a place to get, for you know, women who don't have resources, no matter what their age is, to get these services. This is, there's been a national campaign, promoted by groups like Americans United for Life, which I said was kind of like that ALEC equivalent, to defund them. There's a war, you know, on Planned Parenthood. That's its own separate story in a lot of ways. But that's, you know, that is going on, and it's going on at the same time as you have, you know, a war on the public school system, and you have, you know, a war on labor unions. It's all part of one large war.
Right, and it explains why people like Pope in North Carolina, who is, you know, closely affiliated with the Koch brothers, why they will fund these movements when, you know, their allegiance to the ends, or, you know, the notion of abortion is probably less than their desire to motivate and to fund basically an electoral stalwart of the right.
Yeah, I mean, I think it ultimately comes down to economics. I mean, you know, you look at people like the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers, at least David Koch, has been you know, open and honest about his views towards marriage equality, and, you know, he supports it. So they've never said anything about reproductive rights. I don't believe they necessarily have a real, you know, strong opinion on it. But it is a way, you know, the economic elites in our country, they need this quote-unquote social conservatives, you know, to ally with them. They need them to go vote. You know, they're not going to necessarily get all the bodies they need unless they get this group. And so it's very beneficial for them to fund this other side of things, even if they don't personally believe in it. And you know, quite honestly, you know, an upper middle class, let alone an upper class person in our country, could probably afford this kind of procedure if push came to shove, if right. they needed to pay for it privately. But we're, you know, this is really hurting people who need that insurance, you know, who need Medicaid, who need these kinds of state programs that no longer cover these kinds of things.
All right. Now, this is the point as we start to wrap this up where you mentioned the good news. I know that it's that you included some in your piece, but, you know, I mean, sadly, I have the feeling that the good news here is far less than the bad news in this instance. And, you know, I'm sure your editor would remind you, you got to put in some good news here to give people some hope at the end of this. So right. let's do that.
We're not big on hope, no.
But is there a broader awareness? I mean, I have to say, on a national level, there seems to have been at least some greater awareness by the Democrats, at least, that there is no compromise here. And we definitely saw that in 2012. On a state level, are we seeing the sort of like tactical and strategic and organizing that we need to push back on this?
I mean, I think so. You know, I think so. It's certainly you see, you know, people like State Senator Wendy Davis from Texas, who's now running for governor, and she became so famous last year for holding that epic filibuster of a, you know, a package of abortion restrictions that was ultimately passed. But she tried to hold that off for 13 hours and made sort of national news while doing that. You know, you see individual people running for offices that are obviously, you know, very much pro-choice. But and you do see efforts by groups like the ACLU and NARAL and Planned Parenthood to push back against these proposals. You know, a lot of states have these laws on their books, but it doesn't mean they've been enacted. They're frequently contested. And so there's a lot of these laws that are now wrapped up in litigation. And that is, and in, you know, in some cases, for example, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, they took, you know, legislating abortion to the city level, which is, you know, a first time thing in our country. And the city rejected it. But as I noted in my piece, they rejected it, by 55% to 45%. Only after the pro-choice movement outspent the pro-life movement by like 3-1 or 4-1. Mm. So, I mean, I think the good news is that there are certainly a lot of extremely motivated activists who are making this their life's work. But the sobering news is that, you know, there are still a lot of people in our country who either don't care or who truly believe that abortion is wrong. And, you know, you're not going to change those minds, but the question is, can you change the minds of those people who are sort of on the fence?
Right.
And, you know, if you look at, say, the 20-week ban, which is the big issue now that's being talked about everywhere, that is actually making abortion unavailable after the fifth month of pregnancy. And there are lots and lots of people who, you know, even sort of theoretically support a woman's right to choose, who would sort of feel a little uncomfortable with aborting a fetus at 5 or 6 or 7 months without thinking of all the reasons why one would do that.
Right.
And so that, you know, this is something that the right banks on. And those kinds of measures have been pretty successful, actually.
Well, Janet Reitman, contributing editor at Rolling Stone, thanks so much for your time today. We will link to your piece at majority.fm. Really appreciate the chance to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Sam. Anytime.
All right, folks. Well, before we go into the funner half of the program, let's do a little fun tease, shall we? because we did hear a fun tease, because this de Blasio story, where he apparently, if I understand the story correctly, President Obama allowed Bill de Blasio the weather changing machine, which of course the president uses at different times to I guess distract people from Benghazi, or I'm not exactly sure why.
This is an important program that we developed, the secret black Muslim CIA, and I want you to be the first to use it.
So he was, apparently, de Blasio was able to make it snow extra on the Upper East Side. And then, of course, as the Post reports, he and people should know the Upper East Side, I believe, is the one district in New York that he lost.
I think in the primary, I think he actually won it in the general.
Oh, really? Are you sure?
I think the only place that he straight up may have lost was Staten Island.
Okay. Well, Staten Island, yes.
I think he actually did take it.
I don't know why he didn't hammer those Staten Islanders, but because the Upper East Side is known for the one percenters. I had a friend of mine who who writes about finance. Said that he was talking to people on the Upper East Side who were just terrified of Bill de Blasio. They just thought, like, they're going to have to move out of their apartments.
And rightfully so.
Large families are going to move in because, of course, the apartments would be, I guess, what would be the word? Not nationalized, but
nationalized,
cityized. I don't know what it would be.
Seized.
Yeah, seized.
Like the Sandinistas.
Here is a writer and a lifelong Upper East Sider and mom, Molly Jong Fast, saying of Mayor Bill de Blasio, he is trying to get us back. He is very divisive and political. By not plowing the Upper East Side, he is saying, I'm not one of them. But we have everyone on the area of the Upper East Side. We have rich people, middle class people, and housing projects. We have it all. I can't believe Blasio would do this. He's putting everyone in danger, added fellow resident Barbara Tamron. How does someone give their name after a quote like this? How insane is
this?
Yeah,
I said something totally crazy. Use my full name.
It is spelled C-R-A-Z-Y. I can barely get around, and I'm on snowshoes. All of the buses are stuck and can't go anywhere. He's crazy. We need Mayor Bloomberg back. It turns out Martin Sissy told the Post, de Blasio's trying to hurt the more wealthy people by ignoring us. But there's no logic to that.
Said
you
it yourself,
you
sir.
You may be on to something, Martin. It turns out that, and apparently... The Post cited the city's snow plow tracker as evidence that no plowing was done between East 59th and 79th Streets between 2nd and 5th Avenues. Well, it turns out that the snow tracker uses GPS technology attached to a salting dump truck. And apparently the GPS was out. It didn't work. Which sounds like a real convenient excuse. Of course, it came from Sanitation Commissioner John Daugherty, who, like all smart Sandinistas, knew to get in under the Bloomberg administration and wait until de Blasio showed up so that he couldn't be pegged as a Sandinista. Or as a plowoista, I think, as they call them.
Listen, Bill, here's what we're going to do. I got some people we're going to plant in the Bloomberg administration. And have them lie low.
That's right.
And then,
the first month, have to lie extremely low, too, because no one's expecting you to win.
He's a sanitationista. And, and he said the GPS was down, and he also said the other problem, too many cars on the Upper East Side. Traffic created a big problem for us in that area, he said. I think any of the reporters or anybody who was in that area this afternoon were reporting nothing is moving in the area. The longer it takes for those cars to move, the longer it takes for us to get in there and salt those streets. That's what a big part of the problem was. So it turns out Mayor de Blasio has let us all down. and did not actually perpetrate vengeance on those on the Upper East Side. But it's still, we're still only in January. There's still opportunities. So
hope springs eternal.
I love how these rich people think. Like, in my area of Queens, when I see the snowplows come through, my thought is, oh, I guess they got the rest of the city already.
That's right, of course. Of course.
Well, I mean, in fairness, obviously, Queens should be the last priority.
All right, folks. Number 646-257-3920 if you want to join us, be part of the program. Again, I want to put out the clarion call for libertarians to call today. I would love to hear your explanation of why Freedom Industries, why we should have less regulation even than we do now, and why we shouldn't have more regulation. I would love to hear the explanation of how the free market is going to punish Freedom Industries for seriously, for making people ill. For do we really know what the long-term damages are going to be to the water supply in West Virginia? I mean, just this case in particular. I should also say, as a housekeeping note, I will be on the road tomorrow in Washington, D.C. at the Families USA Health Action Conference. I go every year. I'm never quite sure who I'm going to be talking to there. I'll be doing a lot of pre-taped interviews that we will have in the coming weeks. Tomorrow, I believe I'll be talking to Wendell Potter, one of my favorite interviews, former insurance executive who has a very good perspective on insurance companies, on healthcare. We'll have other interviews over the next 2 days. There may or may not be technical difficulties, because, you know, part of the thing that people don't understand is that, you know, and I was I had this conversation with Michael the other day, because when he came to work here, I said, look, it's all about habit. We need to have the whole setup here so that we don't have to do anything new every day. We need to. And the problem when I go on the road is I figure out how to broadcast, and then I forget, and then I have to reinvent the wheel each time. So it's always a little bit tricky. And then you also don't know what the local situation is in terms of connectability, et cetera, et cetera. But hope springs eternal again. We will be, I will be in Washington, D.C. For tomorrow and Friday. And guests TBD, as it, as we say, in the biz. Folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at majority.fm/become a member. You can find the link at the top of the page. Get the app at majorityapp.com. It's free. And then you can join through the app. It's super easy. 33 cents a day. We have different membership levels. 33 cents a day breaks down to about 10 bucks a month. And then it goes all the way up to a Sam Cedar level for $1,000 a month, wherein you actually get to become Sam Cedar. You do the show. You live with my family. I will probably move to somewhere like Mexico.
We're actually on the third edition of Sam right now.
That's
this is actually happening.
That's right. And my name used to be Ken Stevenberg, and I became a Sam Cedar member, and I took over the show. But if you want to become a Sam Cedar, you take over the show. You move in with my family. I, the real Sam Cedar, comes back for 3 weeks out of every year to spell you, it's usually a seamless transition. I don't even think people notice when Sam actually came back, the real Sam.
That's why
he had a little more tanned.
I just need to say really quick, logistically, some people have been asking, I noticed, about becoming a member not through PayPal, and just email us at Majority Reporters and we'll send you a mailing address that you can mail a check for if that's
right.
Your preferred way of doing it.
That's right. So we will accommodate you. So feel free. And the other benefits of being a Sam Cedar, a lot of sweater vests, a lot of sweater vests, and
–
A lot of sweater vests. So if you like sweater vests and...
get to spend time with Michael and I.
You get to spend time with Michael and Matt and...
Have the occasional conversation with John Benjamin, the sort of passive-aggressive,
right?
Sort of tired morning conversation.
Right, he will text you to ask you questions that have nothing to do with, like, hi, how are you? How's the kids? It's more like, hey, what's an actuary do?
And you won't have to worry about Mark Maron because we've already had him on for the one time he comes
That's
on
right.
a year.
I'm trying to think, like, what the last thing that Benjamin right. texted me was it was, like, he doesn't, not like, hey, how's it going? What's up? He said, oh, yeah, here it was. Who was the rabbi from Worcester who drove a motorcycle and wrote... wore leather jackets. Haven't heard. I was like, Happy New Year. Yeah, no, don't worry about it. Who was that guy?
You should just reply to every text he sends you with, where's Hugo?
Yeah, exactly. Well, he doesn't make those decisions. But all right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me. And in the funner half, we're going to have some fun with the Bob McDonald emails. Those are pretty fun. And hopefully we'll also play this Kevin O'Leary, this Shark Tank moron, responding to a report from Oxfam that 85, is it families or individuals? I think it's individuals around the world control and have more wealth than 3.5 billion people on this planet. And his response is nothing short of morally repugnant. Now, to give him the benefit of the doubt, it's also possible that he just finds it lucrative to play a morally repugnant person on television. But that in and of itself is also morally repugnant. I don't really cut you any slack. If you put that out there publicly, and there is a 0.00001% chance that you're influencing anybody. All right, but we will get to that in the funner half. We got much more in store. All right, folks. See you then.